Tonight, I'm going to discuss the the last two objects of contemplation in the first foundation of mindfulness, and then cover the second foundation. Both foundations are meant to loosen our attachment to the body. You're probably most strongly attached to the body as you. The Buddhist idea of anatta teaches that there's no enduring and separate self. And I've often had people scoff at this notion and kind of gesture to their bodies and say, well, here I am. In the last two objects of the first foundation, the Satipatthana Sutta seems to be asking them, oh, really? These two contemplations look at anatomical parts and corpses. Contemplating these objects also, as you can probably imagine, discourages sensual cravings and ego attachment, the whole infatuation with beauty. Besides being a big component of how people see themselves, these mind states surrounding beauty are usually interwoven with feelings of being attracted or attractive. And these are powerful motivations in physical intimacy. This whole part of our lives involves many other mental twists and turns that all involve attachment, one way or another. It's not to say that we should become monks or nuns, but to be mindful of what's going on. So the body is an object that's very prone to clinging, and thus to dukkha, to suffering. A quick recitation of the Sutta's contemplations of corpses totally does the trick for me, and for many others, instantly overcoming attachment. We go from being enthralled by sensual beauty to being relatively dispassionate about it. Now, some people may think this takes all the fun out of it, but we can still recognize when someone's appearance matches our notion of beauty without having it control our thoughts, emotions, and actions. This mental distance lets us grow into love without taking impulsive actions that lead to heartache and disruption. Last week we covered several easily observed contemplations of the body, the breathing in and out, being aware of the whole body, calming the body. So now let's turn to the next contemplation of the body's anatomical parts. Here's what the Satipatthana Sutta says. The practitioner reflects on their own body, quote, encased by skin and full of various kinds of unattractive things. Kidneys, heart, liver, large intestines, small intestines, stomach with its contents, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin oil, saliva, snot, fluid in the joints, and urine. So, did you identify as you anything on that list? Did anyone think that they're pus or snot? Or someone you know? Sometimes maybe an in-law? A couple of other suttas caution that it's possible to go overboard with this practice. There's a tale of a group of monks that, practicing with this contemplation, who became so repulsed by their own bodies that they committed suicide. The key to this practice is dispassion, relating to things just as they are, without all the emotional baggage that we've attached to the body or to some of its parts. This is where the phrase we examined last week is really put to work, free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. The body is certainly part of this world. It's made up of the same minerals and other substances that everything else, probably throughout the universe, is made out of. The Satipatthana Sutta compares its contemplation of body parts to examining the contents of a bag of mixed grains. This is rice, that's beans, quite dispassionately, as I'm sure you can imagine. Another dispassionate way to view the body is in terms of the four ancient elements: earth, which is solid, air, which is movable, fire, or temperature, and water, dry or wet. This contemplation puts the body on the same level as all other material things. The sutta compares this way of contemplating the body to that of a butcher who's chopped up a cow. It's now no longer a cow, but cuts of beef. The next object might be a bit easier to contemplate when we're close to Halloween. It's about corpses in decay. My neighbors and I recently, quite cheerfully, displayed bodies that were decayed down to skeletons, held together with sinews, as the sutta says, or disconnected bones scattered around. One neighbor was very creative and putting the skull over there and the arms over here and toes there. That's fun. The sutta mentions these two aspects of corpses, plus many others that are a tad more gruesome. And of course, I'm going to read you that too. It says we should contemplate seeing, quote, a corpse cast away in the charnel ground, 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and festering. Or again, as if you were to see a corpse picked at by vultures, hyenas, and various other creatures, a skeleton smeared with flesh and blood, connected with tendons, or a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood. The Halloween skeletons didn't have any blood. And then we consider our own bodies, according to the Sutta, quote, such is its nature, such is its future, such is its unavoidable fate. Despite Halloween, these images still gross us out. We have a massive funeral industry to avoid seeing this stuff. Most people opt for embalming, followed by a tidy funeral, and then being buried. Often the embalmed body is dressed up and made up for display to friends and family, who stand around wondering if the corpse looks just like the deceased did in life. This custom is intended to help us cling to various illusions, that the body, even when dead, is the person we knew, and that it isn't going to decay the way the Sutta encourages us to contemplate. But despite all the funeral stuff, we still know that this is fake. And therefore, we put the body in a box and bury it 6 feet under. Perhaps a better contemplation for our times is what that body looks like when it's dug up years later. This contemplation is intended to undo our very powerful clinging to the body. So it's truly beneficial to realize directly that this body is an impermanent phenomenon. Just like flowers, it changes during life, eventually wilting with age, until it can't continue to function and dies 100% of the time. Every living thing dies. And in the Buddha's time, anyone could see that by visiting a charnel ground. We can see it now too, despite the funeral industry. I personally found the TV show CSI, Crime Scenes Investigators, to be very helpful. I know what a body that's been in a barrel for many months looks like. Volunteering for hundreds of hours in a hospice was very helpful too. And Grey's Anatomy helps with the body parts. This does more than just desensitize us to the natural and inevitable obsolescence that our bodies go through. It frees us from believing that this happens to us. In truth, it only happens to the body. As Anallio says in his book, Satipatthana, these contemplations, quote, can lead to the realization that death is fearful only to the extent to which one identifies with the body. So for the last several minutes, I haven't been trying to torment you, but to help liberate you. You can probably appreciate that we're well beyond watching just the breath with these contemplations. We're focusing the attention on the breath and on other objects, some of which we can feel internally, like the stomach. I've got a pretty good sense of what's going on in there. Or we can see things, or maybe we have to imagine them. This array of perspectives may be related to that puzzling phrase that's repeated over and over in the Satipatthana Sutta about contemplating things internally, externally, or both. I don't know, that's just my opinion. If we've worked with all of the contemplations of the body, we can also observe our emotional reaction to these things, which can reveal and maybe even dispel many very deep attachments that we have. And we'll delve into that more in a few weeks on December 1. That's when we'll get to the third foundation, which is the mind. Next is the second foundation, and it's a much shorter part of the Satipatthana Sutta than the body, but it's also very important. It's about vedana. That's a Pali term for what, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to be calling preferences. Whenever we have an experience, we have a response to it. We like it or dislike it or feel neutral about it. I used to notice when I went to visit my parents in August in Florida that I would leave a cool building, which was my motel, and step into hot, humid air. And a silent little voice inside would go, ugh. And then I'd return hours later to that cool motel room, and that same voice would say, ah. But if you go from one cool room to another, that voice is probably silent. It has no opinion about that. This is vedana, all three of these responses, and it happens constantly. Now, you might think this is no big deal, certainly not after talking about charnel grounds, but it really is important because this perception of pleasure or displeasure or neutral creates a rut in the mind, a habit or a tendency of thought and action, so that next time you have to go out into the hot, humid air, you might think, I need to go outside, and before you know it, the thought comes up, I don't want to. What else could I do instead? This happens without coming into your conscious attention. We get conditioned into thoughts and conduct by preferences we are not even aware are developing. I have an intensely unpleasant reaction to lima beans and Brussels sprouts. Once, for a very big occasion, I went to Chez Panisse and was enjoying a magnificent dinner, especially the vegetable dish. And I realized, to my shock, that I had been munching on both of these despised vegetables and enjoying them. That had become a deeply ingrained prejudice, preference. And in fact, I still have it. But next time I'm at Chez Panisse, I'll definitely give them another try. I think the secret is in how they're prepared. Now, I do contemplate having these two preferences, and if they ever lead to dukkha that I can ascertain, I will be prepared to let them go. I also don't equate these food preferences with me, which is something that we do with a lot of our preferences. I once was getting to know a fellow who literally defined himself in terms of what he liked and what he didn't like. I ended up not really liking him. Anaglio points out that by contemplating our preferences, we decondition them, gaining more control over our thinking, emotions, and behavior. So this is about getting to the roots of bad habits and digging them out. This can involve habits much more important than vegetables. How many people do you know who totally lack any annoying habits? Most of us have some edge that makes our relationships difficult. Maybe an intolerance to the way others annoy us. This is the realm of Vedana, our feelings in response to all experience. It starts out as just that whisper of pleasure or displeasure, and it grows into wanting or craving on the one hand, and avoidance or rage on the other. I was taught to work with these preferences by Yvonne Rand, one of Western Buddhism's first women teachers. She called the forms of clinging that cause our dukkha difficult emotions in her 7-week course that started the day after 9/11. So we had a lot of difficult emotions to work with. She explained and illustrated the steps by which our apparently innocent liking or disliking things grows into clinging and dukkha. This growing into craving and clinging is the teaching called dependent origination. We're born into these bodies with consciousness, which connects with the material world through our senses. That contact immediately results in one of the three forms of Vedana. They dig ever deeper channels into our minds until we have craving, like my lima bean aversion or my chocolate infatuation. If they are allowed to keep growing, they become clinging, an irresistible thirst for something other than what is in this moment, goading us to seek what we desire or eliminate what we hate. How do we keep our preferences from growing into craving and clinging? The instructions are simple, although the practice usually requires a lot of repetition. When you encounter something that pleases you, recognize and acknowledge that. When you encounter something that displeases you, know it. The neutral stuff may be harder to recognize because our response is to not really notice them. But when you've gone for a while without any response to anything, notice that and get to know how that feels. In my recent talk on wholesome pleasures, I told about walking mindfully around the campground where I was on a retreat and seeing a campsite that gave me a strong feeling of pleasure. I liked it, and I noticed that I did. In a nanosecond, the thought arose, I should move my camp here. If I hadn't noticed that cause and effect of feeling and thought, it might have led to some dissatisfaction with where I had already pitched my tent, which would be a hassle to move. So I dismissed the thought. As a result, that dissatisfaction never arose, and I was quite content where I was. Now, I had been practicing fairly continuously for over a day when this occurred, so mindfulness of body was well established, which helped make it possible to see Vedana arise and cause a thought that could lead to suffering. There's a reason that Vedana is usually called feeling in English, because it's something we feel, however faintly, however easily it is to overlook it. So to contemplate when pleasure or dislike arises, we have to be intimately in touch with the body's sensory experience. To do this, we need to practice with the body contemplations we covered last week, so that during meditation, we can experience this link between mind and body. With every breath during meditation, contemplate the sensory experience of the body. with thoughts that distract us, it's a great opportunity to see if we liked or disliked what that thought was about. Not by thinking about it some more, but by turning attention immediately and exclusively to the way our body feels about it. The tactile experience of being pleased or displeased. Once we're familiar with the body's emotional responses, we can contemplate our preferences as they affect us during daily life. When we say, read a menu to see what sounds good, or arrive at some event and see who's there. Just notice what strikes a chord of liking or disliking in the body, feeling pleasant or unpleasant. Try to notice the neutral too. Sometimes it feels like being bored, especially if we had other expectations. Yvonne Rand concentrated on thoughts and feelings farther down the chain of causation, which arise from mental habits that are already ingrained in our minds. She illustrated this with a theoretical family fight that escalated into a vase being thrown across the room, and you storming out of the house. Her instruction was simple. Catch this as soon as you can in the process of escalation. So initially, your goal is to realize you're angry before you leave the house in a huff. If you can't bring yourself to apologize, at least don't leave. With that, whenever this scenario repeats, the next time you do apologize. And then the time after that, when you pick up the vase, you put it back down. You don't throw it. After that, maybe you stop before you even reach for the vase. And so forth, step by step, cutting that chain of reactivity. Eventually, you don't get angry in the first place. This can take years, but it's worth it. Some fine day, you find yourself recognizing when you first have a pleasant or unpleasant feeling about something. That lets you easily control any thoughts that could lead to dukkha. And that's liberation. Before I leave preferences, I want to warn you against confusing neutral vedana with equanimity or nibbana, something that I've heard many times, even by teachers. Anallio says clearly that, quote, the neutral feeling is predominantly the result of the bland features of the object, end quote. It leaves us feeling bland, which may seem better than being upset. But when we have no desire or aversion needling us because we have equanimity, it's a very different experience. Instead of the indifference that's part of neutral vedana, equanimity allows us the full range of engagement with whatever is true here and now. We are motivated not by likes or dislikes, but by unattached love and goodwill. Thank you. Now, before I set you loose in our discussion period, I have a couple of announcements. As I think I mentioned, I'll talk about the mind on December 1st and Dharma, the fourth foundation, on the 15th. And in between now and the next time I'm here, I'm going to be entering a new decade of life. And I wanted to share that with you because you've been such a big part of this decade, the one I'm going to be in for a few more days. So thank you for all that you've done for this decade. The Donna basket is over there. There's an envelope in there. If you want to give Donna, as a result of this course, not this Dharma talk, because that Donna is split with the church, but the practice exercises or any practice support that I've given you. And also, if you were new last week and didn't get this week's email, it's because I didn't take the sign-up sheet home. But if you haven't received an email from us for several weeks, it's probably because we don't have your address. Maybe even we don't have it correctly. So you might want to very clearly write your email address on the sign-up sheet. And I've got it in bold. Rebecca, take the sheets home. Okay. So, your comments, please, or questions.